So yeah, without further ado, I'm going to talk about some fairly recent work for a new direction in my group about thinking about microbial diversity. And these are the folks who did the work, mostly Anna Posfai, who's been a postdoc in the group and really drove this. And I want to say that for those of you who were at Punkage's talk yesterday and also at Terry Hua's talk, this is kind of an odd marriage of the two. I'm very appreciative of those guys for motivating this. Also, there were some questions during Punkage's talk about the role of trade-offs in the kind of resource competition models that he was studying. And so you could view this talk as an extended answer to those questions. So, So without ado, let me dive in. This is going to be all theoretical work. I only have a modest number of slides, I hope, so people should feel free, I know you will, to ask questions. So the issue, as pointed out by Punkage and others here, is that there's a ton of diversity out in the world. And we're go out into nature. I actually have not done this myself, but I believe it. You go out into a tropical rainforest. I'm not sure I recognize 300 different tree species, but people who do go out and count them, and then in some 100 meter by 100 meter space, you find 300 different tree species. Now, I'm a little more familiar with the microbial world, and I do believe this as well, that if you go into the microbiome out in the soil, also consider what's living on our body, you find hundreds and even thousands of distinct genomes out there. And so we're surrounded by this explosion of diversity in the natural world.
So I believe that statement, but what does distinct mean in the context?
I don't want to answer that question. It's just, it's like a bacterial species. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. These are things that are sort of different enough that they don't have, they're not just a few point mutations apart, that they have, a significantly, let's say, 10% of the genes at least are different in each of these genomes. And you notice that this is an order of magnitude range. So as your definition changes, you might change this. So, but I think you'll agree that these numbers are large compared to one, even here. And yet, when one writes down simple models, one is faced with something that the ecologists call the competitive exclusion principle that Punkage also pointed out, that at least mathematically within these models, you find that two species that are competing for the same limiting resource can't stably coexist. In effect, one of them is more efficient at growing on that resource than the other, and it will eventually take over and drive the other one to extinction. And of course, if you could add more resources, and I think Punkage does this in a very legitimate way, thinking about secondary products that the cells are making, the number of species can increase, but it's still limited by the number of resources. So you're not, in these models, you don't get more species than you had resources. And so this was first highlighted in the context of something called the paradox of the plankton by G.E. Hutchinson way back in 1961. And he wrote in a very compact way, a limited range of resources supports an unexpectedly wide range of plankton species, apparently flouting the competitive exclusion principle. And so people have been aware of this this contradiction between what we actually see out in nature and what our simple models tell us. And so, of course, people have been very active in thinking about what could be going on, what are we missing? And there's lots of very good ideas about that. Here are some of the things that have been explored. Generally, these models assume a steady state, but of course, under the right circumstances, you don't necessarily get steady state in a nonlinear system of equations. So you could get oscillatory or even chaotic population dynamics. And this could enable the existence of more species than limited here. Typically, this number is not much larger than provided by the number of resources. And furthermore, this doesn't really deal with the issue of evolution. As you evolve the species to become more fit, these oscillations or chaotic behavior tend to go away. But there's lots of other things that could be going on. And of course, the real world is filled with changes in time. We have weather changes, seasonal changes. So you could argue that this sort of steady state that has that is central to this this map never is reached. That the world is always changing so fast that maybe something is more fit in one time, but then it's less fit in another, and there's room for lots of competition. Another thing that's certainly relevant in the real world is spatial variation. We look out and the world is constantly changing in space. There are gradients of all sorts of things that are important: temperature, salinity, exposure to light. And you could argue then that really there's no well-mixed system out there. Everything is experiencing gradients, and therefore there are all of these different regions where different species could be most fit, and therefore, again, you could have lots of diversity. And you know, it's biology, so there's all sorts of other things that we don't immediately think about, or at least I don't, which is predation by larger organisms, phage. And frankly, I'm not going to argue that any of this is wrong. I mean, I'm sure, actually, that essentially everything here is relevant under some circumstances and to, you know, some of the diversity we see. And so I could just end and say, you know, biology is complicated, there's all this stuff going on, and so what are you going to do? But that would be a short talk, and we still have some time. So I'm going to do something else, which is I'm going to take a clean slate, take a fresh look at this, and say, okay, maybe there's, you know, something that we're missing. Maybe it's not even something that's that hard to look for that will help us understand this diversity. And I want to say, whether you believe my answer or not, which is fine, I do want to highlight that I think there is a problem here. And the problem has to do with this large number of different trees or large number of different bacteria out there. And it's a problem that is particular, I think, to physicists, although certainly biologists should care about this as well, which is that we don't have a way of estimating this number. And I want to go back to some formative experience I had when I was young, like many members of the audience. I was a graduate student at Cornell, and a great physicist, Victor Weisskopf, came, and he gave a series of three lectures to us. And the three lectures were a trip through all of the scales in physics, from the highest energy scales, shortest time scales, the Planck mass, telling us, you know, how would we know when, you know, gravity and quantum mechanics should start to interact? And you could write down a little formula and plug in some numbers and tell us that scale. And he worked all the way down from that, all the way down to living organisms and hydrogen bonds. And basically he said that, you know, a good physicist should be able to estimate any number to within, certainly an order of magnitude, maybe a factor of two. And he did it in front of us, three lectures. We have no estimate for the numbers I just showed you, like the number of trees, why isn't it 30 or 3,000? The number of bacterial species, why isn't it 10 or even larger than it is? And this is a very bad situation to be in. We are irresponsible as scientists if we can't, you know, at least put a good estimate on this number. And so that's the challenge. I'm not to tell you. You get to the end of my talk, and you're going to say, "But wait a minute! You didn't tell me how to estimate this number." And I thought, but let's keep it in mind that it's an important challenge. And as we are in this school and in this workshop, we should be trying to see our way to making a real estimate of this number. So
maybe you're telling me this, but Pukish was telling us that you could have mutualism. You could have it's not simple competitive exclusion in general. Resources that are excreted or exported and they're consumed, does that change things?
Yeah, I mean, that certainly increases, you know, as Plunkett showed, and I totally credibly, you know, you're feeding these things a single sugar, and yet you have more than one species. Well, something that's eating that sugar is processing it, it's releasing something that still has energy content, something else can eat that, there are other secondary products. But you know, I would be very skeptical that there are 2,000 or 18,000 different secondary products that are driving the diversity in the gram of soil. So I don't think that number of how many additional small molecules you can make from glucose is enough to give us that estimate. Now, if you think you can come up with, you know, 10,000 different, nutrients that are sitting in that gram of soil, I'm willing to discuss that with you. But I think that we're still missing something. Yeah?
Just to follow up, maybe it doesn't make a difference, but so going back to 2008, this ecology letters paper is a similar model, except they didn't put in the direct metabolic intermediates. It was just you had these species, they were net competitors, but they're consuming one resource, but there were positive interactions. And then the species, different species become limiting resources for each other. So even though the intermediate, there doesn't have to be metabolic intermediates, it just has to be that these species are somehow limiting each other. Then you can get an unbounded number of species on one resource.
Okay, I think I put that back in the category of lots of interesting explanations. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to, I mean, I won't contradict that, although I feel like you have to argue that if there's something other than resources, well, what is it? Well, there's some antibiotics, there's some things that degrade the antibiotics. I think mm-hmm. I think you can get some ways that way, but I don't think that that's what's going on, that there's that many different factors.
I don't know what you were bearing in this previous slide, but I think I can make this comment anyway. You talk about a lot of species, but so why does the ecology problem have to do with how 16S defines species?
Well, I didn't say 16S.
However,
why isn't, why don't you have a few genomes that that just dominate? That's the question. Like, why not say a much smaller number that you come up with, 10 things that do different things metabolically, given 10 different secondary resources, and those genomes just take over. I haven't even begun actually. So you'll see. I mean, you can then legitimately complain after you see what I have to show. Okay. So what are we going to bring to this that might be thought provoking? And it's exactly the kind of thing that Terry was talking about, that there's a limit to what any organism can do because its proteome is limited. It's got all these things that it has to do and a limited concentration of protein. And so the idea is really that there are trade-offs. You aren't going to be able to be better at everything because you're limited by exactly how many proteins you can have inside a cubic micron. And so we're used to this, of course, in our own case. We walk upright, and of course, we had to give up wiggling our ears. So, we're used to trade-offs. The exact formulas for this, Terry hasn't yet discovered, but someday we'll understand all of these trade-offs. But at least in the case of microbes, we have a pretty good sense that the proteome is an important limitation.
Look at the more serious issue, though. Every trade-off behind it is a constraint.
Absolutely. Yes.
This word has been so used so much. Do we even know?
I'm going to introduce trade-offs. I think in exactly the way you would want me to, which is that I have a limited protein budget. Okay. I don't know why I put words in your mouth, but that seems to be a...
But what does that have to do with genomic plasticity? You can have transcription plasticity, but you could still have different species that have or different genomes, or a single genome that can produce different proteomes.
Yeah, but if you're making one kind of protein, that you're not making something else. That's all.
But if you can switch, there's not really a trade-off in that sense. The trade-off is...
Well, okay, I think that's a good question. So the question of regulation is a good one that I'm not really going to touch on today, and that would be a very natural direction to go in. That's a good point. Boris.
I think we can all agree that there is a problem, and we can let Ned an opportunity to propose a solution.
Thank you. And it's just fun, okay? So if you don't let me go, you will not enjoy the fun of the next few slides. Okay, so getting back to business, what are we actually going to do? Well, we're going to write down one of these resource competition models, and it's going to look exactly the same as what Punkidge had. And we're going to consider it in essentially exactly the same situation, where I have, I have some number of resources, P resources, which is going to, for us at the moment, going to be some small number. Typically, I'm going to look at 3 because it makes pretty pictures. And then I have a bunch of species in principle. And this is my definition of a species. It's a little vector, and each of these represents, say, an enzyme that processes a particular resource. So there's a kind of one-to-one correspondence between the number of resources in the model and the number of possible enzymes. And you can have each species just makes sort of a certain ratio of each of these of enzymes. And the whole idea of the trade-offs, which is the only thing that's different from the usual resource competition model, is that there's a sum rule on these enzymes. So here's your enzyme budget. Some enzymes may cost different things than other ones, but in a few minutes I'm going to set this to 1, and it doesn't matter, so just ignore that. And so the idea is that I'm going to put a bunch of species together, maybe in a chemostat, I'm going to mix them up, and I'm going to feed them certain concentrations of different nutrients. And you should imagine here that like these are different sugar sources. So these are all different carbon sources. I could grow on any one of these to provide my carbon and my energy. And each species here is simply going to have a certain composition of enzymes. So this one here is a specialist. It only imports, you know, sugar 3. This one is more of a generalist. It imports some of each, but the sort of the thickness of these arrows is all supposed to add up to the same. You have the same total number of enzymes that you're all able to put into carbon import, because presumably the rest of your enzymes are going into ribosomes and to catabolism and things like that. Now, graphically, this is simple. Because there's a sum rule, I can write down a little triangle here, a little simplex, and every species is some point here, some ratio of the different enzymes. And so here's your specialist, here's a generalist, and this is going to be useful later. I could actually consider different supplies, and if I sort of keep the total supply the same and just change the proportion, I can also represent the supply on the same plane if I normalize it properly. So this supply is somewhere here where it's a mix of the different sugars. Okay, so that's the big picture. We're going to be interested in what kind of dynamics happens inside of this, say, this chemostat with these species. I have to say, and this is again very important, that the concentration of the molecules in here is going to reflect not just the rate of supply, but also the rate of uptake. I think Pankaj made this point very clearly, that the microbes are conditioning their environment. And so we have to write down equations not just for the populations of the species, but also for the concentration of the nutrients. And so that's the usual thing. Yes, Shel.
So you're treating this as one enzyme per substrate, but what if it's a long pathway?
Yeah, that could change things somewhat, because it has, you know, there's more costs, and then you have to worry about what your internal concentrations are. We've done some work along those lines, and I just don't want to go there today. I think that the take-home messages are going to be similar, that you have to think, I think that you have to think about trade-offs, and you have to think about the microbes conditioning their environment. But the details are different, admittedly. This is the simplest version, and I'm going to be pressed to get through this one, but we can take this offline. So the dynamics for the nutrients look something like this. There's the, you know, the rate of change of nutrient I depends on the supply. There's uptake by the cells that are there. This is the sum over all the species, the population of each species, how much enzyme of that type that species has. And then there's an uptake function per enzyme, or processing function per enzyme. And I've written down a Michaelis form for this, but it doesn't matter. As long as this is some simple monotonically increasing rate as a function of the concentration, all of the results are the same. But you can imagine that this is a sensible choice. And in principle, you could have some loss, but if the cells are doing a good job and taking things up very quickly, the loss that you get, say, by the things that drip out of the chemostat is going to be negligible. Okay, so that's gave us the dynamics of the concentrations. We're going to be interested in a quasi-steady state, so very soon I'll set this equal to 0. But for the moment, let me move on and say, how do species grow? And species grow by uptake of these nutrients. So the growth rate of species sigma for a given concentration of nutrients is some benefit for that nutrient. Again, I'm going to set this to 1 without loss of generality. So it's basically just how fast that particular species of bacteria is sucking up nutrients, sum over all the nutrients, the enzyme fraction that goes to that nutrient, and this uptake function. And then, overall, there's some population dynamics, which just says that your overall population, is going to change exponentially with a growth rate minus some death rate. And this is, in a chemostat, this is just going to be dominated by dilution. Things, cells are dripping out at some rate delta that you, as the experimentalist, control. But in nature, there might be something else controlling your death rate. So again, I'm going to keep this as simple as possible. And so, as I mentioned, this term is generally negligible anyway, so I might as well set it to zero, just say that everything that comes in gets eaten by something. I'm going to separate timescales. Again, Punkidge argued for this, and I've gone through the numbers, and it's like a factor of 1,000 separation in timescales between how quickly the nutrients turn over and how quickly the cell population turns over. So that's a reasonable separation of timescales. And as I said, all of these differences that this enzyme costs a little more, or takes up a little more sugar, that can all be absorbed, and so we're just going to set these into one. And so that's it. And now I just want to study the dynamics of that system. So let's do that. Let's look at some examples. Yes?
So now the interspecies interactions are hidden here somewhere?
They're entirely through the nutrients. That is, the nutrient dynamics depends on the populations, right? And the growth rate of each population depends on its uptake of nutrients. So they only know about each other because they're all eating the same stuff. They're all competing for the same nutrients.
So you don't have toxin, antitoxin?
I have none of that, right? I mean, all of that is real. I don't doubt that it's important. But I just wanted to see what you get if you just have this usual model, throw in trade-offs, something that we do believe exists.
Let me go putting trade-off as a volume constraint, then that constant E you wrote probably should be a function of the dilution.
It could be. I mean, but yeah, sure. But let me just run the chemostat at one dilution rate for now. Okay, so what do you get? Well, let's look at this graphically for this equation. This is the population then is going to just take this equation, plug in the growth rate that I've got there, and say that, oh, okay, if I take this at steady state and ignore this term, then this uptake rate is really simple. It's just the concentration of, you know, sort of the uptake, which is just then the supply over all the guys who are eating it. So there's a very simple closed set of equations for the populations. No, nothing new here. So what does that do? So let's consider a case where I have two species, one that is sort of more specialized down in this corner, one is a generalist, and for the moment I'm just going to supply all the nutrients equally. This is not particularly important, but I'm not showing the dot right in the middle of this equilateral triangle. And let's look at the population dynamics, and nothing particularly surprising happens. The species that whose uptake profile is closest to the supply profile takes over, the other one goes extinct.
Sorry?
Yeah?
What are the axes on the triangle? It's just alphas?
Yeah, these are the alphas. So if you live in this corner, then you're only uptaking this nutrient. Okay. And if you live right in the middle, you're equally. Yeah.
But you also have enzymes in the same triangle or something? I'm trying to remember.
So these are the distribution. This is a species, and the species is defined by its distribution of these three enzymes. So it lives somewhere. It's either a specialist here, specialist there, or some kind of generalist that lives in the middle. Okay. So what happens if I add another species? There, it's kind of closer, but not as close to the center as the blue one. And maybe no surprise. The blue one still does better. The green one and the gold one go extinct. Maybe this one goes extinct a little faster than before. This is seeming rather boring. I add another species, maybe it's a little bit above this one, does that matter? No. So we're not even getting, you know, three different species to survive with our three nutrients, we're getting one. But you know, don't go to sleep quite yet. I'm gonna move this red one up there to that corner, and now they all survive. So this would be a good place to stop because it's like a mystery, and we can come back next week. Something at least different has happened, and we can ask: am I cheating? Have I somehow made some interesting combination of these that exactly balances each other in some way, and therefore I've got a point, you know, that's of zero measure, so I can do some more. I'll throw in another species way down here in the corner. Seems like it shouldn't do very well, but it actually survives also. Then I can start throwing in a bunch of random species, and they all survive, and they're all doing pretty well. Like, this is, you know, this is 100, and they're all like within 10% or something in this case of, and I just go crazy, and everybody gets to survive. Okay, so what has happened?
But it doesn't happen this way.
Nature. I mean, this is a very simple model. I'm not pretending. Okay, I certainly am not overclaiming here. I want to say I think this is interesting and worth thinking about. The take-home messages are going to be quite simple. That you should probably pay attention to microbes conditioning their environment, and probably while you're at it, you should pay attention to some trade-offs. This is just to be, you know, be thought-provoking that suddenly adding trade-offs at least gave me something different than what I had before. Yes.
So just to be clear, all of these dots were randomly thrown in?
Yes, those were randomly thrown in. Yeah.
I mean, the trade-offs underlie all that other theory that you sort of dismissed at the beginning, all the standard, none of those things with spatial and temporal heterogeneity, multiple resources, work traditionally unless there were trade-offs.
First off, I wouldn't say I dismissed them. I presented them, and I didn't accept that as the only thing.
But they also do require trade-offs,
very, very important. Yeah, agreed.
So is that some sort of sweet spot, or is it the number of ones that you added?
You're going. It's generic. You'll see, and I'll show you in a moment that. And in fact, once you understand it, you're going to say, well, that's kind of obvious. It's and probably boring, but for the moment, enjoy not knowing the answer. Yes.
I assume so that you did that assumption of sort of assuming the last term of no washout. So I assume you've got a full simulation.
Yes.
You
include that. That does not affect this at all. Yes. That's I am. The trade-offs are the only thing that is mathematically important there.
I'm enjoying this tremendously.
Good.
But what about number fluctuations? You can't have less than a single organism in differential equations.
Yes.
Once you touch the boundaries here,
it
will extinct.
Yes, we'll get there. And that will, first off, this is 100, and that is, 90.6 or something. So these guys are not, this is not a log scale for the moment. So these guys are all there in some reasonable number. But yet, your question is well posed, and if we actually think of a system that has, you know, guys with births and deaths, we could ask what's going to happen, and I will do that. And you will see that it doesn't actually change the sort of general behavior, and it even gives you some things that look like things in nature. But let's get there. We're going to get there. But first, let me, you know, give away, you know, the punchline, who done it. And the way to see that is actually to think not just about what the populations are doing, but what the enzyme, no, what the substrate concentrations are doing, what the nutrient concentrations are doing. And so let me now do a slightly different type of plot. This is going to be just for this case where the number of species equals the number of resources for pedagogical purposes. And now what you're looking at here is in this same little triangle, here are the three species that I'm going to put in there. And now what I'm varying is the nutrient supply. Instead of putting that right in the middle, I'm going to just let that be anywhere. And I'm going to say, look at two things. I'm going to like who survives and what is the resulting nutrient concentration. And indeed, if I put the nutrient supply down in this corner, the red means that only the red species survives. Up here, only the blue. Here, only the green. And in these mixed regions, like purple, blue, and red survive. And you get this variation. But in the middle here, what this means is if I put the nutrient supply inside this little triangle, gray means that everybody survives. And why is that? Well, you can see that if I look at the nutrient concentrations, there's this continuous change. As the supply is changing continuously, the steady state solution is changing continuously, except in this middle where it's all gray. And that means that for any nutrient supply inside of here, at steady state, the concentration of all of the nutrients is equal. Even though the supply is not, I mean, it's different inside here, different places. But what you get at steady state in terms of the nutrient supply is they're all equal. And that is all you need, right? Because if all of the nutrients are at the same level, and you have a certain number of enzymes that you can distribute to import them, but they're all equally good, it doesn't matter how you distributed your enzymes. You know, there's three equally good carbon sources, and you can put a lot of enzymes on this one or divide them up, you're going to import the same amount of carbon. And so the answer is, you know, that what's happening is that even though you're supplying nutrients at different rates, the population's response, so the guys who eat the first nutrient, the nutrient that's most supplied, actually grow in population, and so that nutrient concentration comes down until all the nutrients are equal, and then it's an equal playing field. Doesn't matter what your distribution of enzymes are, you're going to grow at the same rate. Questions?
So are those the polytopes that Pankaj showed yesterday, where you had sort of these kind of sectors of species coexistence? And
yeah, so exactly. So the idea is that there is, maybe I can draw a picture. This is very much what Pankaj was drawing the other day. Let me do this for just two nutrients. So here's nutrient number one, and here's nutrient number two. And because I have trade-offs, every species has a growth rate curve of a constant growth rate that's just a line somewhere here. So a species here's a species, and you know here's another species. And these are all growing at the same rate, G. And here's another one. And I'm going to try to draw this right. Right? And because of trade-offs, these cross at a point. Right? There is a point where nutrient 1 equals nutrient 2 that any one of these species has the same growth rate. So the idea is that you know, the trade-off condition tells me that I'm only allowed to use lines that pass through this point. And therefore, I can use as many of them as I want. If the actual concentration reaches that point, then they all grow at the same rate. Now, that doesn't tell you the concentration always reaches that point, right? You can see that sometimes one guy survives and sometimes two, but there are conditions where which are not in fact complicated. And in fact, the condition is, let me just say one thing. What is the condition to get the nutrients to all come end up at that equal concentration? And it's just the convex hull. That is, if the supply lives inside the convex hull of all the species, then that is the steady state nutrient supply, and everyone gets to survive. So let me at least show this, and then we'll come back to questions. So here's a bunch of species, lots of them. But the nutrient supply is outside the convex hull. I stretch a rubber band around these and the supply is outside. Then no diversity. Everybody, except in this case, one species goes extinct. But I add one species out here such that the convex hull now surrounds the nutrient supply and everybody gets to coexist. Yeah, there were some questions. Yeah.
In this original model, you kind of assume that you have 100% conversion efficiency for all the nutrients with all the enzymes. I mean, if you relax this assumption that some of it goes to heat or whatever, then the constraints would be slightly different for different species, and all these planes would be tilted
exactly.
To each other.
So anything you do to break the equality of the species, that would be one example, just giving one guy a slightly bigger enzyme budget or a slightly different death rate, will mean that you will lose diversity on some timescale set by those disparities. Okay. On the other hand, and I will hope to get to this, if you introduce other sources of stochasticity in the system, like births and deaths, then you have a question of comparing timescales. Is the timescale that it takes to lose diversity, if that is faster than other timescales, then the diversity will go away. On the other hand, if that timescale is slow compared to, you know, births and deaths and immigration by other species, then in fact that time scale is basically irrelevant, and you might as well have had these perfect, the perfect balance. I will try to make that more concrete in a moment. Yeah.
So I was just going to say, I don't know where this is in terms of your thing. So first of all, I find this extremely interesting. I think you've kind of overturned a lot of the sort of Tillman-esque theory about the, and so I think what you found is kind of a mathematical sweet spot that those analyses missed, where essentially you've sort of combined the sort of some of the neutral theory, which I've never been a huge fan of, with sort of the resources, number of resources, number of species equivalents, and sort of found that actually the two converge on a central idea up in your gray area, so to speak.
Well, I hope that the recording caught that, because I want to put that on my webpage.
But I suspect that really is a deep mathematical error. I mean, to get these results, because this has been looked at pretty closely. Oh, no. There's a deep mathematical
error.
Nobody made an error
to that literature, actually. They basically assume there's a fixed point and this is neutral. So if you go through the papers in the 90s, they actually... Ned is my postdoc advisor. Ned is my favorite scientist, but it's not true that they were as lost as you're claiming they were.
Okay,
they,
but
they
I think
actually understood.
In general, the idea is that you say, well, look, let me say that we reach some generic point of concentrations. And for a generic point, things aren't meeting at that point. And so, okay. I mean, I know the literature, too. I mean, there's nothing wrong with anything that was written, except that I think they overstated the generality of...
they just said it was isolated fixed points, that if you go through the math literature.
Okay. Okay, well, this is kind of important. It's true, this is only one point. And if you say it's only one point, it can't matter. But if the system self-organizes to that point, it does matter. Okay, now we're in agreement.
So
yes?
How much all of this relies on the fact that your trade-off is exactly linear? Because you say it's the trade-off is enough, but you have exactly additive...
I think it does matter in this case. It does matter, and that kind of thing is interesting and worth following.
Didn't you have one where everybody died on the...
What's frozen? What can an organism adjust?
These guys are very dumb. They don't regulate. They don't regulate. They just make a certain composition.
These are science 3 enzymes in some positive function. The only thing is that
only the population can change.
Right. So just by changing that. Okay.
Yeah. That's the model. Okay. Okay. So but I think really following up exactly on what Rich said here, that you look at this thing and okay, it's kind of, you know, it's fun and you understand it, but you get stuff out of it that maybe does have some connection with reality. So for example, this gold guy here, right, it made all the difference, right? So I would say, hey, this gold species at least acts as what people call a keystone species, right? It's and this keystone species, which is required to get diversity, it's not like at the bottom of the food chain, right? It's not like it's grass, and if you don't have grass, then you can't get rabbits and foxes. It's sort of a dynamical keystone species, because it really depended on what the nutrient supply was and what the other guys were. But in practice, you know, this guy, its presence or absence, makes a huge difference in the amount of diversity that you end up with.
Very simple question to make sure I understand. Can you choose where the resource dot goes so that
this is the supply,
right?
You're the experimentalist, you get to put this anywhere you want.
What I'm saying is, can you put that somewhere so that everything coexists except for like one or two drop out, or
no
it's all or
explicitly not, right? As soon as you've got this a condition where all of the nutrients become equal, then absolutely everyone gets to survive. It is exactly neutral at this point, so that these guys, they're all growing at the same rate, and they all have the same death rate, the same growth rate. And so indeed, you've gotten to a condition where essentially this is a neutral model, right? For anything that you'd want to think about, like fluctuations, births and deaths, and so on. And so I want to spend a minute and sort of say, well, what kind of things do people think about in terms of neutral models, and can we make any connection to that?
Here you go. There are two time scales, right? There's a time where you reach that neutral point, and the time where the species can die, right? So if a species dies before you reach that neutral point...
No, but here, I mean, these are two different dynamics, right? This one is finding the nearest fixed point where all the concentrations are equal. And I should say, this is a good point, this is only one of a whole family of solutions. If I have more species than resources, there are many different populations that will all give rise to the same fixed point in the space here of concentrations. So there's a big degeneracy here. This is not the only possible order of these species. It's just the one that happens to be reached from this initial starting point.
Yeah, but there is a time scale where you reach the straight line. And still the lowest one went from a number to 10 to the minus 3. I mean, you could imagine that it will go extinct.
Yeah, so if this is getting back to David's question, well, what if there are only 100 guys here and this one goes below 1, right? Yeah, then it would die out and that would be fine, right? Because the other guys are, it's still neutral. That's exactly the kind of thing you see in a neutral model, that you fluctuate around and when one goes to 0, it's gone. Okay, let me, we've got 15 minutes. I can actually do this. So let's look at the neutral model. I think Pankaj knows more about this than I do, but I'm standing up here, so I'm going to give my quick version of this. And the idea is very, very simple. And the only reason that it's kind of worth showing is that there's actually a lot of data out in nature that does hew to the neutral model. And so people do think about this a lot. You know, why does this seem to be a reasonable description of nature? And so the idea, here's a very simple version. You have an island. Here are trees on the island. A tree dies, and now what happens? Well, there's room for another tree there, and so either one of the existing trees gets to reproduce and fill that square, or sometimes some other tree from another island that I am not showing gets to immigrate, and maybe that's even a different species. And this just goes on and on indefinitely, and what you end up with is a bunch of different trees, different species on your island, but you get some rank abundance curves. You get, you know, what's over time, if I average, what's the abundance of the most abundant tree? What's the abundance of the second most abundant tree? And you get curves, and they depend, of course, on the rate of immigration compared to the rate of death. But, you know, people work hard and measure this kind of thing out in nature. And so here's a rank abundance curve. Here's the highest ranked guy has some percent abundance up here for the tropical wet forest in Amazonia. And this has a very long tail saying, okay, there's lots of different, you know, species are present. So maybe the immigration rate is high so that things are coming in, you know, relatively fast compared to the extinction rate. Here, bats, you know, has a rank abundance curve that falls off a lot faster. There are just fewer different bat species that can invade. You get a bunch of curves like this. And the idea is that, which I'm not showing, is that you write down models like this, and you can get curves that look exactly like that. Okay? Otherwise, this wouldn't have been as interesting, because you'd say, but look, I don't really believe that all trees are equal or all bats are equal. They're different. Why should I get neutral rank abundance curves? So we can ask the same kind of question in our model. We can say, if you introduce births and deaths and immigration to this very simple model with trade-offs, what do you get? And so this is just doing exactly that. You take that same system, but now you let the populations be discrete instead of continuous as some function of some discrete time. And you take time steps. You start from some initial populations. Each time step, you randomly select an individual to die. Of course, the probability that comes from a particular species reflects the fraction of the population of that species. And then what are you going to do? You're going to fill that empty spot in your model, in your chemistat, with a new individual. And with some rate new, that's an immigrant who has some new species with some new distribution of its enzymes. And with probability 1 minus new, you pick it from the existing species, but not randomly. Now you're going to pick it according to the growth rate of those species, so that these guys still in principle could be different, right? And so you ask, what happens? I'm going to move around now in this little discrete space. This actually does map onto the deterministic model. I don't want to go through the mapping, but if you have large populations, then it's just like you had this like this continuum model. But let's say we don't have such a large population. We have 100 or 1,000 individuals.
Sorry, Ed.
Yeah.
I don't see the immigration term in the deterministic version. Shouldn't you have a new?
No, we didn't. Sorry. No, in the determinist, I was saying, sorry, the immigration is new. We didn't bother doing that before. Okay, because we never, we just didn't bother doing that before. So this is just saying, now we have immigration, but if you had these large populations, then the immigrants, you never really paid attention to those because they were always order one. So if you only paid attention to existing things at order n, you wouldn't pay attention to this. Sorry, that was I glossed over that. But now we do want to pay attention to immigration, right? Because otherwise, if you don't have immigration and you have a neutral model, things fluctuate, things go extinct, nothing new can happen, and eventually you just get one species, and that's it, and the system just sits there. So immigration is critical to getting any kind of diversity if you're allowed to fluctuate to extinction. So what do we get? Well, we can do this model, of course, and we can look at, for example, we can look at anything, but we can look at rank abundance curves. And so the red are what we get. You know, this is with a relatively high immigration rate. This is with a lower immigration rate. Obviously, low immigration rate, almost all the time you're up here with one species dominating. But with high immigration, you can get a bunch of diversity. And the green curves are what you get from exactly the same model where you assume perfect neutrality, right? So these are the neutral rank abundance curves. And I would say that, you know, you've got to count a lot of bats to ever see any difference between these curves, right? So if you went out to if you were a field ecologist studying our model, you could count bacteria, you know, for years and years, and you would say, I have perfect agreement with the neutral model. And that's interesting. It's not terribly surprising. I've argued that our model effectively is neutral, but it's a dynamical neutrality, right? The collective became neutral. But you realize that if you actually did a different measurement, if you went in and you grabbed one of those bacteria and you grew it on different carbon sources, it would have some distribution of enzymes and it would be unique. And if you took another guy, you would find that that bacteria grew well on different sugar sources, and you would say, they are not neutral. These guys are clearly different. On the sugar sources that are being supplied, there must be niches for those. And someone else would say, but it fits the neutral rank abundant curve. So you have these two communities, which you do have in the real world, of neutral theorists who say it's all neutral, and niche theorists who go and measure things and show that every organism is different, and trees like different amounts of light, and bacteria like different carbon sources. And if they were studying this model, they would both be right. Because this model, at least, reconciles these niche and neutral theories. Because the individual species occupy niches, they like particular sugars, but the collective has an emergent dynamical neutrality and collectively behaves neutrally. So everybody can get along.
All right. Photosynthetic communities are not fundamentally different than bacterial communities?
Wow, that's
a light as a resource, right?
Yeah. That's a sort of impossible question for me to answer, but light, I think, is tricky here because, like, light is. I think. I don't see how I could map this onto light, right? Because light is, first off, there's one sugar, one resource. If there's really only one. This is boring if there's one resource, right? Then there's only one enzyme, there's only one thing you can do. And furthermore, I don't know how you kind of consume all the light to bring it down to one level. Like if there were two types of light, I don't know, maybe that's true. Actually, maybe that's true, right?
Yes, because your picture had trees.
It's called shading.
Yeah. Well, that was my introduction.
In water, I mean, people are actually seeing some of this partitioning in prochloroplast.
Yeah.
That wasn't even my picture. I borrowed that picture. That's somebody else's picture. They're friends in ecology and evolution. You can criticize that. All right. So does this thing hold up, right? We've had questions about how much how much I've cheated and fine-tuned things.
There's a question in the back of it.
Oh, sorry.
No, sorry. I wanted to know, how does this result depend on the population size?
Well, okay, this does depend on the population size in a way that I will show you now. I mean, up till now, with absolutely equal trade-offs, nothing particularly happens in the population size. I will get those same rank abundance curves and so on. But the population size does become important if I start breaking that assumption about the trade-offs being actually equal. All right? And it's sort of the usual thing that if I have a small population, stochasticity is relatively more important and other stuff doesn't matter. If I have a really big population, I could actually see small differences. Like if one species had a bigger enzyme budget than the other and a huge population, then there would be enough time, you know, stochastic effects would be small enough that, you know, eventually the guy who had the lower enzyme budget would die out, even in the face of random births and deaths. So it's a short answer to your question. Okay, so let's consider some natural type of variations that could happen in the population. Fluctuations in the nutrients certainly seems relevant, and also the fact that maybe trade-offs aren't perfectly equal. Some guys might have more access, be able to produce more enzymes than others for unclear reasons. So certainly this one against population disturbances is very robust. I argued that, in fact, there's a whole family of solutions for the populations that are consistent with tuning to this equal concentrations. And what happens if you disturb the population, if I take the system and I kill a bunch of these guys, is the system just relaxes to another one of those fixed points. So there is an attracting manifold of solutions. You know, the more species I have, the bigger the dimension of this is, but it's always an attractor. So I mess up the populations, and on a quick time scale, it just comes down to the nearest point on this attractor, at which point all the concentrations are equal, and from then on, everything is absolutely neutral, and there's no dynamics in the deterministic model. Okay, fluctuations in nutrient availability. What if I'm feeding it one mix of sugars, and then I switch to another, and so on. So if I just do this once, as long as I keep the nutrient supply inside the convex hull, then it just relaxes to, you know, another population, and everything is fine. And I could say, but what if I do more than that? What if I start fluctuating this guy around outside of the convex hull? And one thing we found mathematically, and we can prove this in low number of dimensions, not yet in high, is that it's only the average nutrient supply that matters. If the average nutrient supply lives outside the convex hull, then you lose diversity. If the average nutrient supply lives inside the convex hull, you maintain diversity. But this nutrient supply at any given time is able to fluctuate outside. It's just the average that has to stay inside. So what happens when it goes outside is a bunch of things start to go extinct, but then the nutrient supply changes and they come back. So you are able to see this in the face of a varying nutrient supply, again, subject to this convex hull condition.
Unless you get unlucky, right? I mean,
well, so again, if you have finite numbers, this guy could go to less than one and be dead. And then if you didn't have immigration, you know, over time, you would lose diversity. That's true.
Low dimensions in what quantity? Right?
Low. Oh, this is just, okay. Low means two.
two
nutrients. We can prove this with two nutrients. But I think it's true. I'm not. Anna is like 10 times the mathematician than I am. She couldn't prove it, but maybe there's other people who I'm sure there are other people who could. But I think this is right. This seems to hold up very well.
So that also means that if you add one nutrient in the environment specifically, you could drive the system to extinction somehow. I mean, to most species disappearing.
If you add a nutrient, yeah. That seems right. I have to think about the geometry of that. Okay. So, but I did want to get to this, which I think is important, which is, okay, up till now we've had a mathematical equivalence of all organisms, at least at the level of the sum of these enzymes. What if you relax that? And so what if we sort of add some random noise to your budget without a sum rule on the noise. So you could have, you'll have some species that have a little bit more total enzymes, some with a little less, and for the heck of it, we'll add a little bit of variation to the death rate. And so what happens then? And the answer is, you know, probably what you might have expected, that if you have too much variation, like if you really let this thing change by order one or something like that, so that some guys die twice as fast as others, you really lose your diversity. The rank abundance curves basically fall off like a cliff there. On the other hand, if these differences are not huge, so here's the case with perfect sum rule, no noise. If up to some kind of transition, where you have a few percent in this case of differences in the budget, you still get exactly the diversity you had in the neutral case, and then the diversity falls off at some modest rate. And this is just the same thing on a different scale. And the point is that there is now like there really is just a comparison of timescales. That is, if there's no kind of noise, if I just had like the deterministic model, then the guy who has the biggest budget is gonna win, sort of generically, depending on exactly what the supply is. But there's a time scale over which that happens, right? That depends on how big the advantage of the bigger guy is. If I have now a model with stochastic births and deaths, and extinction happens faster than this deterministic time scale would lead the one guy to take over, then this slow time scale doesn't matter, because you're much more likely to just randomly have one guy go extinct, and it could be the one who's more fit as opposed to the one who's less fit. It's the usual story of small populations. You with a small population, you're dominated by stochastic births and deaths. With a large population, you can be dominated by small fitness differences. This is the same thing. Yeah?
So then the total amount of resource matters, right? Because that's what sets the population size.
I agree with that, yes. So this does depend on the population size, absolutely. And so this number is not universal. This depends on how big the population is.
How big are the population?
These are small. I think here it is. There's 100. There's just 100 guys here. What turns out to be an effective population and what's a flux? Yeah, good question. Okay.
So when you allow for total enzyme budget to vary, you only get one surviving, or can you still get as many surviving as number of resources that are present?
So this is the case with, without stochasticity, typically I think you'll get one, right? Because there's nothing. I'm wrong. I think you can get up to the number of resources, because it's the usual picture. You can get up to the number of resources. Okay, I'm gonna wrap here. So this is just exactly what I said, where we do the calculation that Pankaj was talking about. How does this depend on the population size? And it has some dependence on the population size. Don't want to do that. Because I want to conclude. So what if anything was relevant here? And I think that what's relevant is basically these two things, which I have said, but I want to say it again, that when we think about this diversity and we try to answer this question that I led with, I think we do have to keep track of the fact that organisms are taking part in shaping their environment. I mean, that's Pankaj, of course, made that point, that the bacteria are making secondary products, and without those bacteria, the other ones wouldn't survive. And this is true in all sorts of ways, nutrients, pH, adhesion, everything you can think of. And the other thing is that species are subject to trade-offs. Maybe I shouldn't say the same trade-offs, but they're subject to trade-offs. And this is, of course, accepted and known, but I think this is going to be an important part of our coming up with understanding of the amount of diversity in the world. This truly simple and, you know, maybe just entertaining toy model, nevertheless, actually has some things that map onto observations, including keystone species and this replication of the species abundance pattern from neutral theory. I don't know. I think this is food for thought. I'm continuing to work on these, and I'm going to have lunch with Pankaj later this week, and he will tell me other things that he's doing, and so maybe together we will make progress on this. Outlook, one thing that we're doing right now is introducing spatial structure into the model. I'm happy to discuss that with anyone. This is my new graduate student who's working on this. And that's it, and I'm almost on time. So thank you very much.
I'd like to have students first.
Yeah, students first.
I have a question.
Wait, I see a student.
Has an answer.
Right.
So how important was like the linear structure in all of this? Like, you have a bunch of like, there's like lots of terms, lots of things are getting added up. It seems to me like, okay, you know, when I have these like linear equations, it's easy to get them to be, I guess, like underdetermined, and so you can get lots of different solutions in there. Like if I start, you know, if these trade-off manifolds start becoming a little curved and stuff, does it fundamentally change things, or is it just that, okay, I have some lower dimensional constraint on this space, and that's enough to...
No, I think the linearity does play a role in this. Like, I mean, if it's strongly nonlinear, I'm not exactly sure why that would be, why you would have a strong nonlinearity in you know, producing enzymes. There is not so much of an efficiency of scale in the organism. But I think that's relevant if you're considering, someone mentioned longer pathways. You know, what if I have to have many steps here, and then I have to keep track of the internal concentrations and so on. I think those nonlinearities can occur, and is an interesting question. I don't have a better answer than that.
Well, I think you answered it with the last slide. I just wanted to make sure. So in the deterministic model, it seems like there's a feature that I guess is in a lot of deterministic models, where the species don't have to be equivalent in the sense that they can have these different enzyme concentrations, but they have to be equivalent in the sense that some of the enzyme concentrations and the death rates for all the species have to be exactly equal in the deterministic model.
That is correct. And if you don't have that, there will be some time scale over which you go back to this usual result of no more species than
resources.
But it could
be a very long time.
It could be a long time, right.
Yeah. So what I understood is that the way you introduced the model was to force some external input of nutrients. Can you extend it to something where some species use secondary metabolites of other, or it's a completely different game?
No, I don't think it's a completely different game. So, for example, I think if you make us, you know, if you're like processing a polymer and one guy takes off the first piece and the other guy takes off the second piece, you can end up in the same situation where whatever the nutrients are, whether they were externally supplied or internally generated, get driven to this, you know, this magic point of equality. That's something that I'm pretty sure of. So I could, by the end of the week, I'll tell you that.
Okay.
I started thinking about it after I heard Pankaj's talk for the second time. So. Work that out. Yeah, in the back.
Coming back to the question that you posed in the beginning, so if I interpret your scenario correctly, it means that the number of resources does not limit the number of species at all, because you under the scenario, you can sort of put in an unlimited number of species, even if you just have the two resources. Is that right?
I think I would soften it a little, but that's basically the idea, that there are going to be a bunch of resources that are not the things we add. I think, you know, Pankaj is absolutely right about that. But that in fact, maybe each of those resources can support additional diversity than one species, because you're ending up where, you know, the species are seeing some suite of resources, but the resources are sort of equally valuable, is the idea. That's sort of the idea. Because the populations have adjusted to the point where you've made the resources perhaps seem more equally valuable than they would have otherwise. You know, glucose is great, but there's less of it. Acetate is not as good, but there's more of it. And therefore, there's not as strong a drive for, you know, one strategy to, you know, for, you know, per resource, and that's all you get. That would be
my question. Was that, does it make any sense to think about more than one constraint, or does that sort of reduce to the case of a single constraint?
I'm not sure, actually. Like, within this framework, I'm not sure what I would do, but I think you could introduce some other, you know, thing like, I mean, once we have a spatial model, for example, I could start introducing spatial constraints, like some guys are stickier than others, and do you go to the place where it's sticky, but there's lots of other guys competing for territory, or the place where it's you can't stick, but it's a good question. Thank you.
It strikes me that sort of a key aspect of sort of testing the relevance of all this is going to come down to, and you didn't touch on it, but I think your model doesn't allow invasions when rare, except sort of for the three that set the condition. I mean, everything sort of, and in the discrete model, you have immigration, so I mean, that introduces lots of real-world complications, but basically, it really comes down to a neutral model that's generated by this kind of, to me, unexpected.
That is actually absolutely right. And it, you know, you basically it generates a neutral model, and then everything that you know about the neutral model is relevant.
Because it does seem like, I mean, in sort of taking the ecologist point of view, there's just I mean, we see, you know, invasive species just taking over entire communities and so on, suggesting that many natural communities aren't sort of at this front where they're just limited perfectly by some constraint. We see an invasion when rare that just completely changes ecological communities.
Yeah. Do you see that at the level of microbes? I mean, I'm more familiar with that in something, you know, where you...
I don't think we know. I mean, I think that's a really interesting question.
Sure you do. When you have a pathogen.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah. On that scale, yeah.
Well, that's tricky because you have a very defective system with your immune system and...
But anyhow, you get my point. I mean, a lot of it comes down to invasion conditions.
Yeah.
Your model is more about maintenance of variation than...
I agree.
Yeah, so would we another way to raise the same question is if you show there are, in terms of the abundance curves, it's the same, but would the dynamics be always completely the same?
It's very close. You do find that there are sort of, if you look at the typical lifetime of a species, if, for example, your supply is at the center, your typical lifetime is a little longer if you start near the center, near the edges. But as the total number of species goes up, those timescales converge. It becomes more and more neutral. And in a sense, it's a dimensional question. Like, you have this neutral manifold of a certain number of dimensions, which is the number of species minus the number of resources. As that becomes huge, the fact that it's not purely neutral is, you know, you have 98 dimensions out of 100 that you can wander around in. You don't really care about the two that you're not allowed to move around in. Michael.
Yes, I mean, this is kind of a weird question, but let's imagine that there are three resources, but somehow the community hasn't discovered one of them yet. Mm-hmm. So everybody is living in some two-resource space, and the third resource is totally irrelevant. And then somebody figures out how to use the third resource, right?
Yeah.
And so you get something over there. And then does this model predict that if that guy figured out how to use it well, that everything would coexist? But if the guy figured out how to use it poorly, it would outcompete everything else.
Yes.
But can I build on that? Because it relates to my question, which is...
Well, it could just... I mean, it would just increase the carrying... let's say it's totally independent.
Have your triangle...
Like, if it just picks up this and, you know, it does nothing else, it's like two separate worlds. This guy does well on this other resource, but everybody else is still fine on the...
It does other things too, but I'm just thinking of like, right, you have your triangle, the actual resource supply is over here, and everything is living on this line, and then if something comes out just here, then your thing predicts, right, this guy is going to win?
No, I think it depends on... It has to give up other enzymes to use this new thing, because if that's true, I think Ned's theory is quite robust. It's the most robust version I've ever seen of the neutral model.
Oh, I see. So it could never have lived in the first place on just the two resources.
No, it could. You just have to give up some of the enzymes for the original two resources to make the third one. If that's true, then I don't see anything that's going to really go wrong. If it gets to make that enzyme for free and not pay a cost at the expense of the other two, then what you're saying might happen.
Is the question not about how that map, that interior gray zone itself evolves? Because I think that's what might
happen. Yeah, but I think it's... Maybe I'm putting my foot in, but I think someone said something that introducing another resource could be bad for diversity, right? Like,
if you introduce a new resource, you need to redefine the trade-off.
So. Okay, exactly.
That's correct.
That's correct.
So you would redefine them, and then, of course, if you redefine them, you could be in the regime where it's not in the convex hull,
And
if you don't have to define them, then that means that...
Yeah, if you don't define them, you add this extra resource, nobody eats it. It's just sitting there.
But at the expense of...
Yeah, it's just that if you have one and two, to eat three, you have to give up one and two. And
that's
then,
right.
Then it should be okay.
But Ned, it's coming back to the question of regulation. I mean, if a single species defines this hive that includes the resources.
Yes.
So if it moves a little bit, it can kill all the others.
It can. Yes. There could be a strategy where you, well, regulation, of course, is missing from this. This is what we're working on now. But I don't know. That's true. It's interesting. I mean, other guys could, of course, regulate to compensate. But yes.
So this result comes from some kind of a conspiracy between two sort of the linear thing, right? We're just following up on this question. You have a linear cost constraint, and an output is also a linear function.
The output right. being?
The growth. I mean, it's a linear function of these. Okay. And, and the coefficients of these, in principle, they can be different.
Yeah.
Right. But this linear output, I mean, no, generally this is not true. We wrote a paper a few years ago just for the co-utilization resource in E. coli. I mean, it's a sublinear function. Okay. It's something like, because eventually there's a limit, right? So no matter how much resource you put in,
E. coli is a real organism. I mean, this is a good starting point.
I think once you go sublinear, right, then you're back to basically the dominant one.
Sublinear also depends on which nutrients you're talking about, right? And how those feed into the pathway. So,
you're talking about enough so that they're all adding in the same way, right? If it's the same.
Yeah, Linearity does play a role here. Linearity does play a role here. I agree.
Maybe you're
pointing at one issue, but I think not having regulation is a bigger one. So,
I think regulation may exactly be the one to solve this problem, right? Because an organism actually put all of their thing in one rather than you utilize multiple items. There's a carbon hierarchy control.
I think we agree that we got to pay attention to regulation, and
we'll get coffee on the end.
Yeah,
and ask more questions offline, and we can end the best.
Yeah.